Five, six committee bills to decide upon, and all we want to do is report these out so that they can have a hearing later. Now, if someone has a problem with any one of these bills, then we'll get into some discussion. We've got a reasonably long agenda today, so if Christy, can you give us a kind of rundown on each of these bills?
Well, what I've prepared for you are the major summary is on your sheet. We have copies of the bill if you want to look specifically at it, or in the one case where there's no LC draft yet.
Okay.
We also have all the people who have requested them pretty much are represented in the audience if you have specific questions. They do pretty much what the summaries say.
Okay. LC 835. Representative Campbell has a... Did you want to go into it?
Well, I was just going to say, I spoke with him on Friday, and he felt that it was self-evident and wasn't necessary that he be here. So other than what it says here, you see what I see. I spoke with him, and he felt it was clear. He would ask that you introduce it.
Representative Jones?
Yes, are we in work session?
We are in work session as far as dealing with the committee bills.
Yes, that would.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt as committee bills the LCs prepared for us.
Representative Jones moves that we adopt as committee bills LC 835, LC 1942. There's an LC without a number. Representative Phillips has put in LC 1665, LC 1615, and LC 1926. Is there any discussion? Representative Springer.
Do we know who the requesters are for each of these?
Yes. Representative Campbell, Representative Jones, Representative Phillips.
Each of the representatives? Okay.
There is one, Tom Fenner, Jack Kalinowski, and Phil Peach. Half of them are representatives, and half of them are other folks.
Okay.
Is there any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Miller.
What is a wave pool?
Don't ask questions like that.
If we get this out and get it back, then you can ask all those questions.
We'll get you a hearing and you can just...
Fine.
I have no problem sending a bill out as committee bill because we still will have to go through the committee system. And I don't think we've got the time to judge these at this time. So is there any objections to sending these out? If not, so be it. The first bill we are in hearing on HJR 6. Now, Senator Wires wanted to give testimony and legislative courtesy. I asked someone to find out if the senator was available at this time.
We called his office and left the message. He was not there. I believe Kathleen Buffet from Legislative Council is on her way down to give an overview
okay.
of it.
And we have Ray Phelps. Now, I wanted to wait, Ray, until the others have got up here so you can capitalize for the Secretary of State's office, if that's all right. If everyone would just sit at ease for a few moments until Kathleen gets in here, why?
There they go.
Don't mistake.
We say set at ease, and everybody starts with the doors.
That means you no longer have a captive
audience.
About
10:30, Mr. Chair.
What time's floor today?
11. You better not let them stay till 10:30, or we're all in real trouble.
How bad is it?
No, I didn't. No, I went. Not into the general, but one of those little doomageddies that has like a, when your light hits it,
oh,
it
lights
up, just a little post, whatever they call it. Kind of flexible. Thank goodness.
Nothing serious.
Well, not that flexible. I once hit
one. Hey, Lon.
Ma'am.
And it hit right.
Yourself, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Kathleen Buffet, Legislative Council's office. It would be, I think, a undue and unseemly claim that anybody can keep up with reapportionment in the United States Supreme Court. But this is the latest effort to do so. The Law Improvement Committee had caused to review the reapportionment proposal in the Oregon Constitution in part because of the cases arising out of the last reapportionment, in which the court pointed out some problems with the constitutional provision. And in a concurrence in that opinion, Judge Lindy kind of went through the current constitutional provision and said, you don't tell the court about this and you don't mention that. And the provision, of course, that was in the Oregon Constitution was initiated in 1952, which was long before the United States Supreme Court decided in Baker versus Carr that the question of apportionment was a judicial, justiciable controversy. When I finished with the draft, which would amend Section 4 of Article 4, there was so little left of Section 4, Article 4, it had been cut to ribbons and the material shifted around and it had become almost unintelligible to read. And it was the suggestion of the committee that once it had made its policy decisions, I simply repeal the current law and enact a new section to try and square up the new procedure. And so that's why, if you want to read what's the current law, you've got to hold the Constitution in one hand and endeavor to read this draft in the other. I commend it to you for only one reason that I can think of. It's shorter. It endeavors to set forth the reapportionment standards. It points out, for example, which the current law does not, that the duration of a senator's term, because of the fact that reapportionment affects holdover senators, that's always troubled people. What happens to the, where is the holdover now that you've changed the territory from which the holdover was elected? In order to give time, one of the things the court complained about was that the court was not given adequate time to review the cases. The chronology used to be that the legislature had to have a plan by July 1st or lost jurisdiction. Then the next step was the court had to make its review, also giving time to a plaintiff or a petitioner to bring the suit. When you finished with a calendar of events, the court found itself with maybe 2 weeks to 3 weeks effective time to make the decision, and that was not adequate, particularly if the question raised was quite involved. As it has been in many of these, because the evidence, population evidence, and that kind of thing is very complicated. So this recalendars the events to try and give the court a little more time. The net result of that, in one part, is that the residency requirement that requires a legislator to live in the district for 1 year prior to election had to be adjusted, because by the time you came out with the calendar, you didn't have a year left. So a special exception was made saying that when the events transpire, the period of time between the final court decision and the election constitutes proper residency for that one election, that one period of time, the election immediately following a reapportionment.
So that would carry on for 10 years, and then
right, every
you'd
10th
have to go
year,
back into
you
it.
Would have a shorter period than 12 months on the residency, but it would only occur under those circumstances. Now, this is assuming, of course, that there is no court-ordered or federally court-ordered reapportionment that would have a different impact. They have been able to prevail lately in getting the federal courts to adjust their decisions to reflect a future election and not a past one, and I think that isn't a serious problem. Do you want to go through this as it sets up the procedure, or... I'm just giving you kind of a general background of what the where this draft came from, and
we have Ray Phelps here, and he probably will want to go through it. It's we just want to make certain that we understand the bill, of course, and since you are a member of the Legislative Council, your testimony is very valuable. I don't see a whole lot of new language in here, unless some of these sections are totally new.
That is Section 6 is brand new, because
all the way through there.
Yeah, the other one was so chewed up with the amendment.
That's what I thought. It's okay.
What it does in part is to change the calendaring of events that follow in the reapportionment. You're still told that at the end of each of the federal census enumerations, you're supposed to reapportion, and you're to do it according to standards that are applicable, standards of law, which at the moment may be as much from the federal courts as from the state courts. So the standards are not technically changed in any way. I would say the major impact is the calendaring, trying to work out the time sequence. And that might be more effectively presented to you in a just a diagram, a chart. That's what I did for the committee when I presented this to them when they were working their way through it, was to give them a chart to show how the dates were and how they would have been under the other proposal, because I think that's your major import of the change, unless Mr. Phelps finds something I'm not thinking of.
Okay.
I would submit that chart to you all to have as part for your
as a worksheet for your folks. Yeah, I would appreciate that. I think sticking with this bill, we'd have some kind of a visual. Are there any questions? Kathleen, thank you very much. Is Senator Waters coming in? Okay, Ray?
Chairman, I'm Ray Phelps from the Secretary of State's office, and the my purpose in coming is just to ask the committee to consider a few changes in the timeline, but in listening to Kathleen, in that they were meticulously put together, I feel a little self-conscious, but I'm going to go ahead anyway.
Well, she's standing over there. She's going to watch you.
I know. basically, the amendment pretty well sets out what we had difficulty with in 1981 and provides for more clarity in how to go about accomplishing it. But what I need to bring to the committee's attention would be the timelines on page 1, lines 20, 21, and ask the committee to consider changing the time for which the court reviews from October 1st to September the 1st. The court would begin its review process on August the 1st. That's at line 17. Has 30 days to determine whether or not the apportionment is valid or not. And then if they determine it is not valid, then they should direct us on September the 15th, which would be a date you should insert at line 25. To correct the reapportionment so we can come back on November the 1st to the court to report the changes. As the language is set out now, there is no timeline specific in paragraph C of subsection 2 as to when the court would tell the Secretary of State to correct the errors, only tells us when to have it back. And in 1981, we had just a little over 2 weeks to correct the apportionment plan that the court passed back to us, and we would not have had time, for example, to conduct public hearings as is directed at line 26. So we need some time to accomplish our task as well. Also, the 30 days with the 15 days written response is consistent with the timeline in subsection 3 at page 2, in that the court has 30 days to make its determination and 15 days to either respond that it's the plan is acceptable or to direct the Secretary of State to correct the error. So there is that consistency. Also, at line 4 on page 2, I think that is possibly an error. I think that should be November the 15th to coincide with the date at line 1. So either the court rejects it on the 15th or it becomes effective on the 15th of November. With respect to subsection 5 at lines 35 through 38, the measure 1 at the last general election changed that particular provision, requiring 15% of the gubernatorial vote rather than 25% of the justice of the Supreme Court. And I would recommend that we be consistent and to amend that to reflect that. Those are my comments on the bill. Quite frankly, with those few changes, this bill would, my opinion, cure all of the problems we had in the Secretary of State's office in 1981.
Okay. What I'd like to do, Ray, and I'll ask questions. I want to run this past Kathleen had to leave, so I believe they got it all down there. I agree. I have to agree. Almost everything is based on the gubernatorial general election.
Yeah. And that's okay. The purpose is a recall. For example, what this provision does is it says that the senator would be subject to recall of the electors of the new district. One of the problems you have in reapportionment, particularly with Senate terms, is that reapportionment really doesn't lock in for 5 years. The if a senator is elected in 1980, reapportionment occurs in 1981, that person's not back on the ballot until 84, and you still have intervening elections. So it got to be a very big problem for us is if someone were to want to recall, how would we figure out the signature base and that sort of thing, because the lines have changed, and we'd have to maintain the old records and the new records for half the Senate. Appointment by to fill a vacancy becomes a very big problem if you do not have this kind of language, because the precinct committee persons at the primary immediately following the reapportionment are all running from different legislative districts. So when you want a precinct organization to assemble from a legislative district to fill a vacancy, who do you pick? And so this is why this is very significant. And I can answer other questions for you, but this should correct those technical problems we have.
Okay, because I know that I and several members here were here in 81, and it was the senatorial lines that gave us the problem. The House lines were acceptable, and it was the courts and then the Secretary of State's office had to make those changes. In Multnomah County, we had 13 House districts, but 6.5 Senate districts, so you had that crossover into another county. So
right.
I can understand what you're saying. Questions? Thank you very much. I do not see Senator Wires. Senator Wires was the only one other person signed up. Is there anyone else here that wishes to testify on House Joint Resolution 6? Yes, just come up and...
just to identify. My name is Bob Goldstein, and I am out of Portland and was involved in the 1979 and the 81 proceedings in regard to the reapportionment. The hat that I wear at this particular time is as a citizen advocate, as I did starting at that point. I would like to advise you at this time that I am here not as a part-time legislative aide for Mr. McCarty. This is an ongoing situation. I am hired by Mr. McCarty on a part-time basis. But I would like to first advise you that I have a deep interest in this matter and did go to the Supreme Court and was one of those, in fact, the first case that the Supreme Court had submitted to it in 1981. Many things have come to my mind, and I wrote for the Hillsborough Argus columns weekly for a full year, stating the unhappiness that I had with the whole procedure in this regard, as far as the Constitution was concerned, as far as the way as to how the legislature itself acted at that particular time. And I do not believe, even at this time, that this will solve all of the problems. I know you will continue having hearings on this matter on Friday you're also set again. And I know that the reapportionment will not take place for another 6 years. But I think that I would like to, if I may, reserve some time, or at least be noted, it would be noted that I would speak again, because I don't want to go into detail at this time. This is primarily to introduce myself to the new members of the committee and those who were here before who were not involved, basically, in the reapportionment problem at the time. There is a House Joint Resolution, by the by, which was submitted in 1979, which did not pass the House, which would have created an independent commission to make the drawing of the lines the final situation. The House did not go along with that, and the Senate did not go along with that, and reserved their own rights to draw the lines. But I think that I have seen violations in that regard And at a later date, I would like to bring them up, Mr. Chairman.
Fine.
So I thank you.
No problem, Bob. And it will be noted that you're here as a citizen advocate.
Rather than as a legislative aide.
That is your position here. It's on tape. Thank you.
I thank you, sir.
Representative Springer. Bob?
Oh, sure. Did I understand that you might have some amendments or at some point later?
Well, I would have suggestions, which I might then at that point.
Okay.
He's reserving his space.
It's okay by you people.
Okay, just whatever you might have, just so it might be prepared in writing, too.
Yes, I would do that.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. We will close the hearing on HJR 6. We will open the hearing on HB 2041. The first person up that I have is Richard McCullough Jones. I believe if I'm correct. I apologize. My handwriting isn't too great either, so.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Richard McCullough Jones, and I'm the member at large on the Builders Board. I want to apologize that our chairman isn't here today, but she's the mayor of Scappoose, and apparently she's got some things to do up there.
Excuse me, who's this gentleman here?
This is Ken Cadell, our administrator, who I'll introduce in just a minute.
Check you off the list so I can listen to what you have to say.
I have a short statement, if it's all right, to read into the records.
That's fine.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the Builders Board and staff began working on proposed amendments to ORS Chapter 701 more than a year ago. We conducted a hearing for the public on May 4, 1984. As a result of that hearing, some concepts were dropped and others were added and others were modified. The legislative concepts were then reviewed by the Director of the Department of Commerce and by the Executive Department. The legislative concepts were then converted amendments contained in HB 2041. The five-member Builders Board and Builders staff believe that the proposed amendments are necessary and that they will overall have a positive impact on consumers and the building industry. At a February 8, 1985 meeting, the Builders Board decided that claim statistics do not warrant an increase in the builder surety bond. And let me just go off just a second to tell you that we consider not only the statistics, but the increase in the values of homes being built from $74,000 to $90,000 as reported in the Oregonian last Sunday. And we considered all the facts in this before making this decision. And our statistics still point out that the increase in bond isn't necessary at this time, but we will be watching that very closely because things change rapidly. We there propose to amend Section 4 of HB 2041. We have also decided that Section 10 of HB 2041 should be deleted. With your permission, our administrator, Ken Cadell, will give a brief description of what the Builders Board proposes to accomplish with the amendments. Thank you.
One thing I want to say is that are you submitting this as a formal request for amendments to 2041?
My letter that I've written there?
Yes.
Yeah, yes, sir.
Okay, because that will be, you have to have them in writing 48 hours prior. This will take care of it because we'll see this bill again on Friday.
Okay.
So I just assume that these are your proposals for the amendments to the bill.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. Identify yourself.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, my name is Ken Cudell. I'm Administrator of the Builders Board, and I'd like to start off by apologizing about the amendments. We plainly didn't review this quick enough to get those in a better fashion for you. If the committee would so desire, we can put those in a different form.
No, this is fine. If you're satisfied with these proposals, then you, of course there'll be questioned at maybe today, possibly, but if not today, certainly on Friday, as to how they would fit in the bill and improve the bill. But before we can consider them, we have a committee rule saying that other than the members of the committee, we have to have their proposed amendments in writing 48 hours prior. this will satisfy, because we will not see this bill till Friday.
Thank you. My comments will be section by section, and the committee should have a copy of this in front of them. Section 1 and 2, I'd like to cover those together if we might. Section 1 and 2, the intent was to define mobile homes as real property for the purpose of Builders Board jurisdiction. Problem being that if the Attorney General has indicated that once a mobile home becomes stationary on a site, it becomes subject to Builders Board jurisdiction. But it's confusing to the public. This is more an amendment that would make the public, those who read the Builders Board law, would be less confused.
Kim, Representative Jones?
All right, let me clarify, if I may. Are you going through the bill as it's drafted, or are you going through amendments?
No. Mr. Chair, Representative Jones, I'm just merely stating from sections 1 and 2 of the bill, trying to define what it was that Builders Board was trying to accomplish and why. I wasn't planning to look at the various amendments. However, there is an addition.
I noticed mobile homes as being one of the things you're planning to change in your proposed amendments under the information just submitted to us. I was looking to find the section that you were talking about where mobile homes were currently being included.
They are not, Representative Jones, they are not currently included, perhaps, but the Attorney General has said that they do apply.
Let me ask that you do this, which would help me, maybe no one else needs this. But if you would give us the line that you're trying to refer to, it would help us in terms of looking at the bill so we'll know what it is specifically you're changing in the law.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bunn.
Can I further clarify on mobile homes, if this bill passes with your amendments, will mobile homes be included under the Builder Board jurisdiction?
Chairman, Representative Bunn, they are included now. It's a clarification that would...
They're included now because of an Attorney General's opinion, is that right?
Yes.
But are they included only under certain circumstances when, by definition, they become real property and not included at other times?
That's correct.
So presently, the Builders Board has jurisdiction part of the time, but not all of the time, is that right?
Representative Bunn, we would still continue to have jurisdiction part of the time. When it's going down the road, when it is a mobile home on wheels, Builders Board would not want to have jurisdiction.
Are there any circumstances presently after which a mobile home has been set up that the Builders Board did not have jurisdiction, or is there a point at which the Builders Board always obtains jurisdiction in the setup process?
There was a point, and there would continue to be a point, the same point, Representative Bunn. Yes, thank you.
The problem, Representative Bunn, is the fact that some people do not feel that it should be registered under our jurisdiction working on a mobile home because they feel it's mobile. Well, we're trying to say to them that it becomes real property when it's attached to the land and you have to be under our jurisdiction.
Further question. Representative Bunn.
In your opinion, is there a need to cover mobile homes? I mean, you're saying they're already covered, and some people didn't know that. Is there a need in terms of the protection of the public to cover mobile homes?
Yes, sir. And there's a need to spell it out exactly when it becomes from being mobile to attached permanently. And that is spelled out by the Attorney General, but there is a need to cover it. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Peterson.
Could you tell me the practical repercussions of having the permanent mobile home under the Builders Board? I mean, what does this mean to the mobile home owner?
It means that when they get work done on that home, if they should have hired a registered builder, because then they're protected by the bond and insurance and everything else. Now, the problem arises that people have come before our board with claims saying, we're not covered by you because this is a mobile home. We've had at least one case that I can remember, and we've had to spell it out to them. Now, by your putting it into the bill, it then definitely spells it out that they must be registered.
Representative McCarty, then Representative
I just want one question to my mind. if they made substantial changes in that mobile home, then would they have to bring it up to the complete standards of a new building? What standard would they bring it up to?
The changes, that would be a case of dealing with their local building permit office through a code situation. The thing that Builders Board would get involved with on that is...
This is strictly the Builders Board?
Yes, yes, sir. And what happens, we don't keep statistics on whether it's a mobile home or whether it is a house, but we get a considerable number of claims.
This just pertains to who does the work then on it, on the mobile home. Is that just what I'm hearing? I'm
well,
just asking.
This pertains to the filing of claims. Maybe I should back up a little bit and say that Builders Board is not a code board. But we take care of, the house can be built to code, but let's suppose that the house is painted improperly and they've got $2,000 worth of damage. They can bring the same would apply with the mobile home. The mobile home would come under a section of codes. We don't deal with codes. We deal to improper work, the filing of claims being brought through an equity system. And therefore, many of the people who work on mobile homes saying, we don't have to be covered by you. The same
Can you tell me just in round figures what your budget was for the last fiscal year and how many people you have on your staff?
Chairman Roberts, Representative Jones, the biennial budget is approximately $1.4 million biennial. The income all comes from registration fees, which are presently $55 per builder. Presently, there is in excess of 13,600 registered builders. That fluctuates this time of the year, up or down by 100 per month, something like that. The number of staff that Builders Board presently has is we have 18 permanent full-time and three permanent part-time or temporary employees.
Temporary and 18 equivalent full-time?
Yes. So it's a total of 21 equivalent employees.
$1.4 million biennial budget?
Yes. Jim Roberts, a statistic that might be of interest to the board on the number of claims. The real important item as far as the protection of the consumer is how many, when they went through all of this process, ended up still not being made whole. In other words, they filed a claim, the bond might have been touched, the builder might have paid the cost, but in some way, most of them are made whole. Now, in a typical year, our homeowner claims will be something in the 400 to 700 of our claims will be from homeowners for breach of contract, for negligent or improper work. Those claims that were closed during the fiscal year ending June 30th, 1984, during that year, only 31 homeowners actually lost money. Only 31. Now, the builders that they were working for, though, we don't find a rhyme or reason as to when they became builders, how long they've been builders, that sort of thing. It seems like the biggest problems they run into are financial as opposed to poor construction. For that same 12-month period, and we just now have our claims into a computer, and like many computers, I guess, we're having difficulty getting statistics out that are meaningful that we can just give to you and not have to, you have to interpret. But for that same year, only 92 builders for a total of 167 claims out of in excess of at least 12,000 builders. 92, that's the all of them that really created problems that cost somebody some money in the long haul. Yeah, that others had some stress on them because they had to file claims, but eventually they got their money out of it.
When you say builder, you're talking about contractor, subcontractor. I mean, the whole building.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
So the number is rather small when you sort it out. You end up trying to process 18 The problem is that when a claim's closed and when it's opened are two different time periods. So matching up the number of builders with for that particular year. But let's say that there were 1,200 claims filed during this same period of time, and you end up with 167 of them were all that really ended up where they weren't paid in full.
Yeah, but what I look at as one individual is, while the numbers, you know, it's fine to have the numbers and statistics. When you get into the human element, you know, that is not small. It's, you've got somebody put out a lot of bucks and ended up eating it. And we had some problems in past times where this committee had sunset review last time. I thought I wasn't going to see you folks for about 8 years, but that's the way it goes. But we're talking about instances where an individual paid the master contractor. The master contractor did not pay the subs. The master went south, and these people had to pay a second time for something.
That's correct. And we've had, since I've been on the board, I know of at least six cases and possibly more, and some of them have already settled. We asked the administrator for some statistics, and there are 18 cases that where a person paid twice, and for one reason or another. Now, we're trying to educate the homeowner that one way of stopping this is to make out your check to the builder and the supplier. And we're trying to educate the homeowner in many different ways through a good education program of what they can do to prevent this. But this is the way the law stands in the state right now, and I feel very sad when these cases come in. Now, sometimes the homeowner panics, sir, and as soon as he gets this intent to file a lien against his house, he writes the check immediately. Now, what he can do is to file a claim with our board, and that stops the double payment until the claim is adjudicated. But not everybody knows this, and we're trying to get this word out to them. I feel very sorry for them. I really do.
I want to ask one question. How long, and I haven't got through this whole bill, how long do they have to make a claim against a bond?
Chairman Roberts, Ken Cudell, they have 1 year from the time that the structure of the work has been completed.
In other words, they signed off on it and they're moving into the house 1 year from that time?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Further questions, Ms. Harris? Sure. Representative Bunn.
I have some real concerns about the amount of benefit we're getting for the dollars expended on these entire programs. You mentioned there were 12,000 builders registered, 92 builders that ultimately had to be dealt with, if I understood that correctly, and 1,200 claims. It seems to me that if we took all the money that's spent on insurance and all the money that's spent on bonds, all the money that's spent on hearings and put it in a pool and hired one person to hand out half of it, we could pay every claim that came in and return the other half to the builders.
Chairman Roberts, Representative Bunn, Ken Cudell. The statistics I gave you were those where the payment was in excess of the bond. You know, on some of, there are others. I was talking of 167 claimants who actually ended up having to have a bill that was unpaid.
Well, were there more than 1,200 claims total?
Yes, made there were approximately 1,200 claims for that year.
Total claims made that
yes.
year.
Yeah. But there were more than 167 where the bond paid some money.
You know, it would be interesting to me to take those 1,200 claims and analyze them, take all the dollars that we spend on this effort, the $1.4 million, all the dollars spent on bonds, all the dollars spent on insurance, put that in a pool and see how far we'd go to pay those 1,200 claims. I suspect we'd have money left over and be able to eliminate probably the cost of 18 jobs.
But not all claims are justified either, Representative Bunn. Some claims are frivolous claims brought against the builder out of spite or any other reason. They don't like the builder, and so they bring frivolous claims. You're going to pay him, sir, money that the claim isn't justified?
If we could pay the frivolous claims, the good claims, the in-between claims, and have money left over, we'd be doing a better job than we're doing now.
Okay. Chairman Roberts, I seem to bog down on the first
first page of this explanation. Well, but
at 10 o'clock, I'm going to call a 10-minute recess so everybody can stretch. The fact, if you haven't anything to do, I mean, if you if you're not into anything new right now, I'm going to call recess for about 10 minutes. Did that bother you? Would that throw you off your pace?
No, if I just make a statement at this point and be very brief with it, sir. Builders Board, and perhaps we should have started this by explaining what Builders Board does in a little more detail, but one of the things that we don't talk about enough, sir, is what we do when a claim is filed, particularly from a homeowner. The first thing we do is send an investigator out to meet with the homeowner and the builder, and more than 60% of the claims are resolved at that spot. That's the service that's perhaps the best service that Builders Board provides. The proposal to have a fund, there was a proposal 2 years ago to have a recovery fund in lieu of bonds. It does appear there's a lot of money spent for this coverage. Builders do an awful lot to protect that very tiny $5,000 surety bond because they know they can't stay in business unless they have that. And so they are doing, it's surprising the value of a $5,000 surety bond. People tell me that's not of any value. But you can see that it is of a considerable value because most of our builders are small. That's all I have.
Okay, we're going to recess till 10:10.
Ken, I would suggest that maybe it would be wise, since we seem to have bogged you down with lots of questions, if you would just like to briefly go through the balance of the bill section by section so we can follow it line by line, and then maybe our committee can hold some of their questions unless they pertain to a specific part of the bill, because I think we did get kind of bogged down. So would you like to continue?
Thank you, Representative Jones. Have with us at the table here also, Mary Lou Riedel is our program manager for registration and claims, and once we get to the spot where you do have questions, some of those will fall into her area, and she would be the one to answer. I think we're on the top of page two.
Yes.
We've had some difficulty. What we want to do here is to define owner to exclude a speculative builder. Reason. An owner can file a claim and can receive the full $5,000 of a claim. A builder filing a claim, a material supplier filing a claim, they can only receive $2,000 of that $5,000 bond. And so the reason we want to need this definition of an owner to exclude a speculative builder is to keep from having this argument with the speculative builder that he or she should be able to file claims with their subcontractors for the full $5,000. So that's lines 1, 2, and 3 on the top of page 2.
Just a quick, if I may.
Springer.
How did you come up with that language? Is this follow anywhere else in statute or from some other states? It may do too much and too little at the same time is what I'm kind of concerned about.
If I may answer that, I'm Marilyn Riedel, Program Manager of Claims and Registration. Madam Vice Chair, Representative Springer, the intent of the language, and believe me, we had a lot of difficulty coming up with language we thought would work, is to allow that builder that builds a speculative home and sells it not to be, of course, entitled to the full $5,000 bond. Perhaps the language could use some improvement, but we felt this would make it clear that an owner that has the full access to the $5,000 bond would not, let me back up, yeah, an owner who has built the house and then means to sell it will not get the whole bond back, but that will be reserved for the true consumer. Does that answer your question?
I think I understand what you're trying to do. My concern is whether or not this language actually accomplishes that. There may be a difference of opinion in terms of that policy, but I guess I'll just have to look at that more closely and maybe flag that for our attention.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, please.
Madam Chair, the last item, I think, on sections 1 and 2 that we'd want to talk of then is lines 41 and 42 of page 2, and it's lines 1 and 2 on the next page. And that has to do with proposing to remove the exemption that commercial lending institutions now have. And we don't have hard statistics to show that. We have, since the amendments were passed and became law in October of 1983, where a developer had to be registered, that was at that time that when a developer came under jurisdiction of Builders Board, had to be registered, it was at that time that the exemption for lending institutions came into effect. From that time until now, we have received 20 requests to file claims. Now, again, we don't have hard evidence. We don't have names. All we have received is people have called us, come into the office, and wanted to file a claim because they were having some problem with their home, and the lending institutions were the ones that were actually completing that home. Most of these cases, it was either the completion of a home or the repair of a home that was taken back by the lending institution. We don't know what happened to those 20 people, so we can't tell you that 20 people got harmed by this. All we can tell you is that we could not accept those 20 claims. And that's the extent of our documentation that is a problem. I'm fully aware that the lending institutions are not going to like that amendment. Section 3, we propose to delete a section from down on line 26.
Can I stop you on what you have? Is it purposeful that you have not commented on line 6 on page 2 or line 3 on page 3? It appears as though those were changes.
Yes, I, Madam Chair, I felt that maybe we'd gotten far enough into the area of mobile homes and
floating homes. Those are corrections that just pertain to the first comment that you made. Are these just?
Yes, those pertain to the floating homes and the mobile homes. So then, if I might, on page 3, line 26 through 29, this paragraph does some things and it also causes some confusion. And the confusion occurs on line 28. And it says, if within any 1-12-month period that person offers for sale 2 or more structures, it's the 2 or more. What we have is builders coming to us, and are those example might be someone who builds one home a year for the full purpose of selling it. But since they're not going to build 2 homes a year, then they feel that they do not have to be registered, that this paragraph exempts them from registration. And the problem then that occurs there is that whoever buys that home from that unregistered person would not be protected with the bond or with the claims processing procedure. So we couldn't figure out any way to change the language and felt that there are other paragraphs that define speculative builders, and so we propose to take that paragraph out. Then section 4, I think that's basically, other than some changes in paragraph numbers. Section 4, when we originally prepared this, we fully anticipated that since it's been 4 years since a bond was increased from $3,000 to $5,000, I think it's been 4 years, that probably our statistics would show a need to increase the bond. It did not show that. The bond is adequate, which makes us very happy. As near as I could determine that we could, if we increased the bond to $7,000 as we had proposed in this draft, we would have in those claims that were closed in fiscal year 84, we would have protected added some additional protection to about 24 homeowners, but it would have, for a total, I think, of $42,000, but it would have cost the industry in excess of $1 million to do that. And those figures just don't add up very well for us, too.
The bond that is put up by the builder, can that be either cash or a surety bond?
Chairman Jones, it can be cash. It can be a deposit.
Or a surety bond?
Or a surety bond, yes.
Okay, so the cost you're relating to would be the amount of the total bond amount, is what you're saying?
The cost that I was relating to would be
not necessarily the same cost it would be if it were put up by an insurance firm, in other words.
What I was looking at is the cost of a $2,000 additional bond going from 5,000 to 7.
Yeah.
In any event, we would still propose that the language in this section that makes it clear how to get and getting this $2,000 bond, that's been somewhat confusing, and it's been in a situation where somebody could have put the homeowners that they might be doing work for in jeopardy by having a $2,000 bond when they should have had a 5. So the other language we would propose that we change, we would like to, the amendment that we're proposing to the amendments would be going back to a $5,000 bond and letting the bond be reduced to $2,000 after the first year under the restrictive conditions, a gross amount of work of less than $30,000, and then certification that they plan to also continue at that level, and then, of course, a promise that they would increase the bond to a higher level if their work did increase.
I think Representative McCarty has a question about this bond amount.
Okay, you said 2,000, you mean 3,000, you're proposed to 3,000.
They removed that request.
Yeah, okay. Now, when was that 3,000, 30,000 in gross volume put into the law?
I believe, Representative McCarty, that was put in 1981.
Then it wouldn't be substantially changed due to inflation now, then.
Yeah, okay.
Small question.
There may be some confusion on that, too. I hope that what our amendments propose here, we don't propose to go from a 2,000 to 3,000 now. We would propose to leave that at 2 for the reduced bond.
I understand what you're saying is you are just simply on line 12 and line 20 asking that no change be made in those figures, that they would remain at the original amount.
And then on line 26, change the 7 to a 5.
Okay.
Section 5 is an area where our insurance requirements have been...
Do you not want to comment on the other part of that, lines 23 through 27?
Okay. Yes, I will. Madam Chair, at the present time, somebody who did less than 30,000 gross last year could come in and certify that they did less than $30,000 gross and qualify for a $2,000 bond when their intent is and their desire is and their plans are to do much more than that. So what our language as it presently reads was dealing in the past, and what we want to do is to deal more in the future. I'm going to do less than $20,000 or $30,000 gross, so I should have a smaller bond. That's the intent of this language. So that, and then if we want to do some checking on this, we ought to be able to get from these people some sort of documentation. We don't want to have them submit documentation each time. We'd like to believe them, but we'd also like to do some spot checking to make sure that that we're not having a problem.
I personally, I will be very honest with you, it just runs red flags up all over the place when I see that you're going to ask and have the ability to get their federal income tax returns. I think that's rather difficult for a lot of people to be willing to submit to a builder's board. have you no other method of consideration that you might use?
Madam Chair, there probably are other methods. We're not aware of them at this time. What Builders Board would hope that you would do is to not take out all of the amendment just to get rid of that particular one. I, too, have trouble with that federal income tax returns, but we need something to be auditing if the need arises. We would propose not to require the information. We'd only want it if we had some suspicion that someone was actually violating the law.
You would not be able to know that if, in fact, you had homes sold in terms of escrow or claims or some other evidence. It would be pretty clear evidence if you had some evidence to show that you had a reason to question. There'd be some pretty substantial proof if that was the case, I would presume.
Madam Chair, if the builder were a general contractor and were building a complete home, that would be something that would be easy to do. If the builder were a subcontractor, that would be rather difficult to check up on and to find out actually what volume of work that they've done. From a statistical standpoint, we don't find much evidence of those who have the $2,000 bond creating any problem. It doesn't appear to be a problem area in that all of a sudden we've got $8,000 claim against a $2,000 bond.
Especially not in this economy.
That problem has not arisen, has not become a major problem for us.
But this is just in case it does?
It's a case of, we do know of instances where a general contractor has said, I did less than $30,000 last year, and within a month after they renew their registration, they then signed a contract to build a new home. They have not violated the law. They are entitled to a $2,000 bond, but in effect, they shouldn't be. Because they certified that last year, when they didn't build any homes, that they did less than $30,000 gross. However, within 2 or 3 weeks, then they sign a contract to build one home, and they still only have a $2,000 bond.
But that wouldn't be changed by looking at their federal income tax return for last year. I mean, you're looking at two different situations as I see it. You're looking at what they might do in the future as compared to what they did in the past, right?
Yes. Yes, ma'am.
Did you want to ask a question?
No, I just share your concern on this particular
okay. Okay, would you like to proceed?
That, I think, is all of Section 4 then. On Section 5, our definition of the requirement for insurance seemed to be somewhat out of date. And so in our discussion with the industry and with those insurance people who serve the industry, we arrived at a more meaningful minimum limit on insurance, and that as you can see here, we're looking at, instead of a policy described as 25,000 injury or property or damage to property, 50,000 for injury or damage including death of any person, and 100 for injury or damage including death to more than one person, we proposed on line 10 and 11 of page 5 that we have a $300,000 combined single limit. And that seems to be the minimal standard for the construction industry, for the home construction industry.
Promised I wasn't going to stop you, but $300,000, no matter whether you're doing wallpapering, repairing door jams, or building $500,000 homes, doesn't matter, huh?
Madam Chair, the limit, the definition that we had before was the same for no matter which size, and so we've just assumed that we would continue with the same definition. There is a small increase in cost, but it's not substantial, and most of the builders have this limit anyway, or a greater limit.
Yes.
Yes, Representative Bennett.
When you say there isn't a substantial increase in cost, what kind of a dollar change are you talking about?
Marilyn Riedel for the record, Mr. Chair, Representative Byrne. no significant cost was found at all. I did some talking to people with the insurance commissioner's office and insurance companies with their comptrollers and others, and found the majority, well, in fact, all that I talked to, would not recommend underwriting any insurance for less than the $300,000 single credit. They just wouldn't do it.
Well, the question, excuse me, go ahead.
And the cost is set out now in the statute, the $25, $50, and $100, is confusing to agents. They often called us, just as a side comment, how do I write this? And we say, if it complies, there's no interpretation. We've asked the insurance commissioner's office for assistance. What kind of policy does this really say? And I just couldn't get an answer.
Well, then let me ask the question this way. What would be the difference in price between a $100,000 combined single limit policy and a $300,000?
I couldn't answer that for you. I could get back to you on that.
I would be interested in knowing the difference in cost. And do you also keep statistics on the amount of this coverage that is used or recovered on? Do you have any mechanism by which you do that?
We do often get insurance certificates from builders that they send in, and in just picking them up and going through what comes in the mail, I would say a good two-thirds are already writing them $300,000 single limit.
Would the one-third that aren't be the smaller part-time or not heavy builders?
Representative, I believe so.
Okay. I have a concern that what we're doing here, if there's any cost factor at all, again, is targeting those small part-timers. And I don't see that the person that's doing a limited amount of activity with small dollar amounts involved needs the same coverage that the $300,000 would be. And it would be my hope perhaps you could check on that and see if there might be a distinction developed.
One more comment, Representative, is that checking with companies that write it now to comply with law, they could write the same coverage or for the same price, write $300,000 single credit and be of much more benefit.
Yeah, my knowledge of insurance is limited, but with the knowledge I do have, you wouldn't write $100,000 combined single limit for the same price you would write $300,000. Now, I can stand corrected on that, but I just...
From the ones I talked to, that was the answer I was given, and I have to profess I don't know a great deal about insurance either.
It'd be helpful to me if that could be checked.
The vice chair just made a statement. Maybe by Friday, because we don't have the time of day, we can get somebody from the insurance commissioner's office.